KaiserNetwork.org.
This is Larry Levitt from KaiserNetwork.org. Welcome to Ask the Experts, our regular interactive web show that provides in-depth discussion of current health policy issues and allows you to interact directly with the nation's top policy experts. The state of Maryland just passed legislation that would require Walmart to pay a minimum amount towards health insurance for its workers, putting the spotlight on budding state efforts to expand health coverage. Almost 36 states are considering similar proposals, and other states, like Massachusetts, are debating even more far-reaching plans, such as requiring employers and or individuals to purchase coverage. Meanwhile, the president is expected to use the State of the Union address next week to lay out a vision for the health system that would involve stronger free market mechanisms and greater consumer responsibility for spending and decision making. Like 15 years ago, there's broad consensus that the health system is in crisis, with 46 million Americans uninsured and costs rising far faster than wages and inflation. At the same time, competing visions of how to cover the uninsured or contain costs persist, and the political path to reform is far from certain. Our focus today is on what states are doing or could be doing to make tangible progress on coverage or costs. And we're joined by an esteemed panel of experts who have both been in the trenches of state politics and studied policymaking from an analytic perspective. Alice Burton leads the State Coverage Initiatives Program at Academy Health and is a former state policy official for Maryland. John McDonough is executive director of the Massachusetts Consumer Group Healthcare for All. He was previously a professor at Brandeis University and served 12 years in the Massachusetts House of Representatives. And Stuart Butler is vice president of domestic and economic policy studies at the Heritage Foundation, where he has served as a leading health policy thinker for over 25 years. You can reach our panel of experts in two ways. Email your questions to ask@kaisernetwork.org or call us here at the Kaiser Family Foundation broadcast studio and ask your question on the air. You can phone toll-free at 1-888-KAISER-8. That's 1-888-524-7378, and we'll do our best to get to as many of you as we can. Thanks to all of you for joining us. And Alice, let's start with you. Give us a sense of the landscape here. I mean, there's clearly more talk among governors and state legislators about doing something about health care. Is there more action as well?
There's some more action. The State Coverage Initiative just released our annual report, State of the States, and we struggle each year to decide how we'll characterize state activities. And this year we titled the report, Finding Their Own Way. And we do that for a couple of reasons. One, I think state policymakers are clearly feeling more on the front lines of this issue around coverage. And for the first time in a couple of years, as they emerge from the budget crisis that they've been deeply in for a while, beginning to think about strategies to address the problem of the uninsured and do it in varying different ways. What's interesting is how different the approaches are in states. You mentioned Maryland in your introduction, and I know we're going to hear a lot about Massachusetts today. Different approaches, as well as Illinois, who's doing a very public approach to expanding coverage for children. So we're seeing very different things in different states. And I think we're seeing some more energy around this issue, not surprisingly, because of the increasing uninsured.
And are there, we mentioned using public programs like Illinois, Massachusetts, which would have a mandate of one kind or another, Maryland, which is a mandate of a sort on Walmart specifically. Are there other sort of approaches that make use of more free market mechanisms or health savings accounts, giving consumers greater responsibility?
I think from a lot of states that I work with have an interest in health savings accounts or want to understand the impact, but it's really a change in product offerings, and they're really, I think, in a wait and see, what will there be take up of health savings accounts in their market, and then they're considering whether they should offer it for their state employees or if they might consider doing something further within their tax code to incentivize the purchase of health savings accounts. But probably what they can do with their tax structure is going to be a minimal incentive compared to the federal incentives for an HSA.
Would you say there's patterns? I mean, are states looking to expand coverage more, control costs? Is there a mixture of both?
Some are looking at both of the problems and quality and recognizing that they need to address all of them. Maine is an example of that, and they are in the first year of implementation or completing the first year of implementation of a program, and they're struggling through the difficult realities of how you fund a program going forward, how you identify savings from expanding coverage for the uninsured and pull that out of a system and use it to finance coverage going forward. But I would say that there are certainly patterns around states looking to the problem of the working uninsured and trying to sustain employer-sponsored insurance coverage, because we've seen the decline in employer-sponsored insurance in the last 4 years or so, 6 million more uninsured there.
And John McDonough, I mean, you're working in Massachusetts, and I think many people believe that 20 years ago, Massachusetts jump-started our last big health reform debate by passing a pay-or-play requirement on employers, which was ultimately repealed. But the state seems poised to pass something once again. Can you give us a quick summary of what the state of play is in Massachusetts?
Massachusetts has been engaged in a red-hot debate about expanding health insurance to the uninsured for about 15 months now. And it's raising a host of issues, some of which are familiar and some of which are pretty new. One familiar issue is, what's the responsibility of employers to their workers? We're seeing a meltdown, as most other states are, in employer-sponsored coverage. In fact, today's Boston Globe, and people should go to their website if you want, has a front-page article about how Friendly's Ice Cream Chain, which is an ice cream store chain in 15 states, has gotten rid of comprehensive health insurance for all of its non-management full-time workers and has substituted one of these mini medical plans out of Arizona, this company called Starbridge.
Sort of a slimmed-down plan that offers...
Which offers for some a maximum annual medical benefit of $1,000. It includes coverage for hospitalization, but includes, for example, maximums in hospitalization of $100 a day. So there is, in fact, and this is being documented in lots of states, including Massachusetts, this significant cost shift from folks who had employer-based coverage onto public coverage, onto Medicaid, or onto uninsured, and thus onto the bad debt of hospitals. So the role of employers is very much one of the hot issues. There's another hot issue as well, which is, should individuals be mandated to cover themselves, to buy insurance? And Stuart's been talking about this for 25 years or so. To our knowledge, and I stand to be corrected, we're the first state that has ever actually had an employer mandate, an individual mandate actually proposed in statute that has actually been approved by a chamber and has in fact really raised the critical question about, okay, if you're to do this, how the heck do you really do it? Because it's actually a pretty tricky thing to do on a state level. How do you enforce it? How far do you go? Who does it fall on and who doesn't? So those are all compelling questions. The third issue we're grappling with, of course, is the Bush administration's different approach to federal 1115 waivers.
And these are waivers under the Medicaid program that give states,
that give
flexibility.
States flexibility. And under the Clinton years, the Clinton folks were generous with giving waivers that gave states flexibility and more coverage to broaden and expand coverage. And under the Bush administration, they're great for giving flexibility for states maybe to expand coverage, but in any way to have flexibility that caps or controls costs. And so Massachusetts, as part of this process, is negotiating its third waiver with the federal government, and the feds are capping the amount of money and demanding a series of changes, in particular switching money in this waiver that has gone to institutions and instead flipping it and requiring that it be used to provide subsidies for individual coverage. So those are just three of about 15 issues. It's red hot. If you want to know more about it, go to our website at healthcareforallhcfama.org, and our Affordable Care Today Coalition is probably sort of one of the best sites that gives you an overview of everything else, just where the issue is right now. The House passed its bill in early November. The Senate passed its bill in mid-November, and it's now in a House-Senate conference committee, and we're expecting something to happen next month. So stay tuned, but something significant is going to happen in Massachusetts within a month, we think.
And you've talked about, I mean, your organization has supported an employer requirement of some sort, a pay-or-play requirement, and you mentioned an individual mandate also being on the table, which the governor has supported. And it seems like Massachusetts has gone farther in potentially merging these two ideas. I mean, there's some circumstances in Massachusetts that allow that to happen.
This conversation is really unique, I think, whether you like it or you don't like it, but Governor Romney came forward with a plan a year ago that said, let's mandate all individuals to have coverage and not require anything of employers. Our coalition of consumers and providers and other folks said, let's have employer responsibility, and we didn't support the individual mandate thing. And the House of Representatives looked at both sides And, you know, the default position when you have this stalemate is to do nothing or to do neither. And instead, surprising almost everyone, the House of Representatives said, no, wait a minute, let's do both. And so our position and our coalition's position is we actually will cross that bridge of saying there should be a legal requirement on individuals to have coverage if and only if, first, it has to be affordable, clearly, and you're not going to punish people for being poor and not having enough money to buy grossly over-expensive health insurance. But secondly, we'll support individual responsibility only if it's paired with employer responsibility as well, so that there's dual responsibility. And then let's talk about doing something. So I don't know a state that has ever really had this kind of a conversation of pairing both together, and that's what makes this really interesting, I think, well beyond the kind of the Walmart stuff that's going on in other states.
And Stuart, I mean, it's pretty clear that, states out there are taking a variety of different approaches. And there hasn't been a lot of activity at the federal level, at least nothing that's been enacted into law to speak of. Do you, you wrote an article recently with Henry Aaron that proposed a somewhat different approach, that the federal government provide financing and flexibility to states to expand coverage and deal with costs. But you let 1,000 flowers bloom, or at least 50 flowers bloom, in the in the states. Describe a little bit your vision for.
Well, I think the vision that Henry Aaron and I, and we he's at Brookings and I'm at Heritage, we don't agree on much, but we do agree on a number of things. One is that, as you already heard, that there's a variety of approaches. We are actually seeing action on healthcare. It just isn't in Washington. So there's this sort of desire. Also, I think, as we've seen in the different states, there are very different visions about what the solution is. And I don't think any of us could honestly say, we know we have the solution. And you've got political gridlock in Washington. It's very hard for any proposal that isn't just mushy to get get a majority in both houses. So given that, what Henry and I felt was that we've got to look at the relationship between the federal government and the states to energize the states, to encourage the states, but with some kind of criteria that one is that we ought to have a national debate and a national sort of goal about what is it we're trying to achieve in this. If it is, well, it should be, of course, include expanding coverage, looking at ways of moderating costs, making sure the quality of care is improved, making sure people are not left by the wayside.
So this might be something like cover X percent of your population.
Something like that. I mean, which is not a simple task, but the federal government should focus on what are the broad objectives. And then systematically allow the states to come forward with proposals that reasonably can be presumed to reach those objectives with outcomes measures. Do they do this? And Henry and I, we disagree on lots of things. We both feel let these different approaches be tried. Let states do that. Let us reward states that succeed and help them to do this. And let's learn from this as to what is the best approach. And it may be that there's no one best approach. I mean, Alaska and New York are not the same. I've traveled and they don't even sound the same when you go there. So they're very different. And so we may have a variety of approaches that fit the political values and the circumstances of different states. But there's a commonality, a kind of an American set of values that and objectives that we have in mind. And so much as I may have some disagreements about what's going on in Maryland and Massachusetts, I think they ought to go ahead. And we ought to measure the outcomes. We ought to see exactly what happened. At the same time as we allow other things. I mean, you've got places like Florida in the Medicaid program, at least, moving more towards a kind of defined contribution model, which is consistent with what a lot of us on the more market-based side would prefer to see. I think that ought to go ahead, and we ought to examine. I don't see any other way of getting progress. I mean, I just think that's, in a sense, the bottom line, that if we think that we should have a newer version of the Clinton healthcare model, which was kind of get all the experts in Washington, the best computers, figure it all out, and then make everybody
do it. The computers weren't so good.
That's right. That is never going to happen, and even if it did happen, it would probably be a disaster, because the probability of us getting all this figured out, I think, is remote. It's better to allow diversity at the state level, but observe it, see what the goals are, compare it with the outcomes, reward success. That sets a different dynamic in place, which I think would be much more productive.
And how much money do you think we're talking about?
Well, you know, in a sense, the line is as much as you've got. I mean, the more you have on the table, the more. But I think we've got to recognize, certainly right now, and quite frankly, I think even if there was a change after the next election, we are not talking about a lot of money. And therefore, I do think a part of this equation has to be changing the way we currently spend, or at least being open to changing the way we currently spend money. That's why I think the Medicaid program and SCHIP have to be part of the equation, at least in states that are willing to do that, in order to reach the national objectives. I'm certainly not in favor of Medicaid changes that just say, well, just throw people out who are sick and reduce our costs. I think it's got to be in common. If you can find a better way of organizing Medicaid and SCHIP so that you reach the objectives of covering people adequately in more creative ways, we're open to it.
You'd put the Medicaid, the SCHIP dollars on the table, let states require things of employers, for example?
Yeah, I think we should do that. I mean, I obviously, like everybody, I favor certain approaches rather than others. I've got a lot of concerns with employer mandates. I think they're bogus in the sense of thinking that employers are some kind of separate pot of money, that there's no consequence of requiring Walmart to cover people. I think it's going to show up in a lower growth of wages and higher prices for their goods. People end up paying the cost in some way. I think if you are not under an illusion, that is a way that ought to be tried in some state. By all means, try it, and let's see how it works and so on. I don't favor it, but the quid pro quo is let other approaches be tried too.
Well, I'm sure John will want to respond to that, but I first want to get to, we've got a caller in the line from Florida. Caller, please go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth, and I'm calling from the state of Florida, Orlando. And I would like to know, aside from Medicaid, is the state of Florida doing anything for state initiatives? Because I'm not eligible for the Medicaid. And if I do sign up for the Medicare Part D, I will then become, my income will be below that of a dual eligible. So I'm between a rock and a hard place.
Thanks for your question. And Alice, maybe to provide a little bit of background, and I mean, Medicaid varies quite a bit from state to state, but it does seem like a lot of the state initiatives, and I don't know if there's anything going on in Florida besides the Medicaid plan that Stuart mentioned, but a lot of them are focused on this group of low-income people who are likely to be uninsured, have incomes or characteristics that don't make them eligible for Medicaid, but don't necessarily have employer coverage available. Is that sort of the target group that the UC state's looking at?
Yeah, I do. I think the working uninsured, again, right above the Medicaid level is usually a target group in many states. But thinking back to some of the earlier comments, the places states are starting is so very, very different. In Massachusetts, sort of where are you starting in terms of your coverage level for adults in your public programs allows more of a conversation around an individual mandate that might not exist in another place. For a state that really has no coverage for childless adults and for parents where they might be covering, you know, about half the poverty level, the concept of an individual mandate there, they really will need to fully address the issue of affordability first. And so that might take it off the plate in some states where it might be more realistic discussion in Massachusetts.
Well, I want to come back to, we've talked about the states having very different approaches. And the only state that I know of that's enacted an employer mandate and actually allowed it to stick, it was Hawaii, which did it before ERISA, the federal law, came into being. And we had an email question that asked how the model in Hawaii is working regarding access and cost containment. And Alice, do you have any sense of how things have worked out in Hawaii?
Well, Hawaii's uninsured has been growing. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but they are concerned with their growing number of uninsured. And what they have, the way their employer mandate works in Hawaii is that it applies to all full-time workers. So it covers both small and large firms, but you have to be a full-time worker. And there are some exemptions.
I thought it was 20 hours a week, actually. More than 20 hours a week.
Correct. But, I mean, there is a segment of the workforce who is not working
under
whatever the cutoff is, and they would not be eligible for this. They would not be covered under the employer mandate. And there are a large number of workers in Hawaii that are under the 20-hour cutoff, more so than other states that have similar kinds of tourist economies, and they've been looking at that data and been aware of that.
There was a study in Health Affairs, I think it was about 18 months to 2 years ago, that tried to predict the expected level of employer-sponsored coverage, looking at a variety of demographic and income indicators. And one of the conclusions was that the one state that was significantly greater in terms of the level of employer-sponsored coverage than the model would predict was Hawaii. And the only explanation they could come up for it was that, in fact, the employer mandate in that state actually did bring a lot more people into employer-sponsored coverage than would otherwise be the case.
And what about Stuart's point that you might be able to increase coverage by requiring employers to provide it, but it has other consequences, potentially lower wages for workers?
Absolutely. I mean, when I buy a car, when I buy a product, I assume that somewhere in that price is the cost of providing health insurance for folks.
If you buy a car,
and that's and that's
I know that very well.
And that's and that's just that. That's what I expect, and I'd prefer not to, when I buy products, know that the people who produce them are working in sweatshops in Malaysia or working here in the United States and are not getting coverage. And it's not, for example, we had a study done in Massachusetts, came out a year ago, that looked at the number of firms with 50 or more workers who were either had 50 or more workers on our Mass Health program, our Medicaid program, or using our uncompensated cure pool. And the top five employers were, number one was Dunkin' Donuts, right? Now, Dunkin' Donuts, they can add a nickel or a dime to the cost of one of those gross latte things with the whipped cream and the sprinkles and stuff. And is that really an awful thing if they build that in? I mean, is that
it's just very important not to be under an illusion about this. But I think
not
a lot of people are.
Yeah.
That they think that somehow there are no consequences of just simply making somebody do something.
If someone has to pay for
I'm a supporter of the concept, at least, of an individual mandate, but I'm under no illusion. If you say to somebody, you must buy a $10,000 health plan,
okay,
it's the law, and if they don't have the money, it's an illusory mandate. I'm also, right, would also recognize that if you do require people who hire lower-income people to cover the full cost of their health care, those employers are going to start making some different decisions about, A, how many lower-paid people they hire, and, B, how much they pay for them. They pay them. Just, we mustn't be under an illusion about it. And let me just finish, though. That's why I think, particularly with lower-paid people, a critical part of the equation is we must give a subsidy in some direct way to those individuals or to the people who employ them in some way.
In other words, not just requiring the coverage, but actually
talk about it. We must say there's no free lunch here. If we as a society say people are below this level of income should have coverage, and I think we should say that, if we say that, to then to say there has to be some free lunch there, we can get somebody to pay for this without it having any impact anywhere else, is an illusion. And therefore, we've got to look at the different ways we could help that person. I tend to favor direct support for people, whether or not they have employment-based coverage, rather than saying, let's make somebody do something so that they shoulder the cost, a narrower group, an employer or just a group of people. I like to see the cost spread as widely as possible. So ironically, in a sense, I'm much more in line with those who say we ought to have a national system and we ought to make a national commitment.
From a financing perspective.
From a finance point of view, my argument would be, well, yes, that's, I agree so far. Now the argument is, how do you best deliver health care and organize it? That's where the difference of opinion tends to show up. That's why Aaron and I can agree on these things, even though we dispute very much about the way in which you carry out a subsidy-based system.
I totally agree. Recognize the costs and factor them in and do it smart and don't do it as a blunt instrument. At the same time, also recognize the flip side of costs on the other side. When Friendly's Ice Cream screws its full-time workers and says, we're no longer giving you real coverage, we're giving you one of these fake insurance plans, then the costs for those folks don't just evaporate into space. They're borne by taxpayers who end up paying through public systems.
I agree.
They're borne by individuals mm-hmm. who then end up in bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. They're borne by other employers right. who are not jumping out of their responsibility and covering, paying higher costs to the hospital
just,
to cover those debts.
Just like people who support single payer.
Both ways.
I agree. I believe that we ought to be helping those people directly, and they shouldn't have to play roulette with where they're employed. That's, I think, part of the real debate here between those who support an employment-based system where the employer is reluctant to do it and those who support not depending on employers to be the cost holder, the initial cost holders of providing coverage. And I think that's a legitimate debate, and we see it sort of at the state level as well as the federal level in the debate that's taking place over the future direction of our healthcare system.
And John, maybe you could explain, because as I understand it, at least one of the elements of one of the proposals on the table in Massachusetts is a payer-play system where employers would have an option for the set of workers part of the system to either provide insurance or pay a percent of payroll, which in effect is a subsidy for those employers that have lower wage workers because what they're being required to pay is lower. And it might not cover the full cost of insurance for those workers.
But it's not a substitute, really. I mean, it's not a substitute for insurance because we know for most employers the cost of providing coverage to their workers is somewhere between 12% and 15% of payroll. And so if we were really trying to make it an equivalent, we'd be talking about a payroll tax at that level, and instead it's a 5% to 7% payroll tax based upon size of employers, and simply as a way to say that there is in fact a base level of responsibility for employers to be involved in some way. And so if you're down at zero, if you're now friendlies like, and you're going to be at like 1% or 2% of payroll, then you're going to make a choice. You're either going to increase the level of benefits you provide to your workers, or you're going to write a check to the state. Frankly, we think a lot of them will, rather than write a check to the state, will actually expand their coverage offerings to their workers. And great. Terrific.
And if they do write a check to the state and that check doesn't cover the cost of coverage, the state will kick in with money.
It's an important element of the financing to create the subsidies and create the subsidies for workers in the smaller firms who can't afford the whole cost. So it's an important part, but it's not the only piece. There's federal money on the table. There's other sources as well that are part of this solution.
Well, speaking of that, let's move to the other side of the country, to Oregon. And we had a couple email questions from Oregon about former Governor John Kitzhaber's plan. And essentially, as I understand it, what he has proposed is give Oregon flexibility to take all the pots of money that are coming into Oregon, whether that's tax dollars, Medicaid, et cetera, put it all into a pot, and Oregon can cover everyone with that money. First, Alice, are you familiar with the former governor's plan?
I have not seen. I've heard some.
Okay.
Yes, but.
And is there? I mean, I think there is a sense out there that you know the United States spends more per capita for health care than any other country in the world, far more, in fact, and that if we just put it all in one pot and organized it more efficiently, we could cover everyone for the same amount we're spending now. Is that sort of a sense you hear from some groups at the state level that this is possible if they could just get hold of all the money?
Well, the related reforms that I think that some states are thinking about, the one that comes to mind is Minnesota, actually has this program called Smart Buy, and there they're trying to bring several of the payers together to think about quality measures, think about sort of purchasing strategies collectively. And I think they've got about two-thirds of covered lives that they think are going to be in this Smart Buy initiative. So I think we see moves towards let's collectively look at some of the issues around cost, around contracting with providers, around quality.
And Stuart, do you, not being a single payer advocate, I imagine, but I mean, is there enough money on the table to actually cover everyone?
Oh, I think there is. We spend, as we can go over the numbers, but we spend a vast amount on health care. The notion that we can't provide an adequate level of health care for everybody with the amount of money we spend, I think few people would not conclude that we could do that. As I said, I think we don't know exactly how to do it. That's the bottom line. No matter how much time we spend in health research or in the field, there's competing views. I like the Kitzhaber approach. When they had their first wave way back in the previous Bush administration, I and others at Heritage supported this. We said we don't necessarily want to live there under this, but that's the kind of approach where they put essentially if you're above the line, depends in terms of effectiveness, you either get the service or you don't.
Particular services.
You know, yeah. Now he's got this proposal saying, well, let's just take all these money in different pots. Senator Groh former Senator Groh talks about, you've got one pot, another pot, and all the other, why don't we just sort of have a general approach? And I think that the Kitzhaber approach makes a lot of sense to say, let's take this money with the proviso, as I said, in terms of how Henry Aaron and I look at this, let's see what the goals are. Let's ensure that the money is distributed and used in ways that meets criteria about what is fair and reasonable within the United States. And let's see how they do. And let's have somebody else take a very different approach. I would dearly like to see the Oregon, the Kitzhaber approach tried. I think it makes a lot of sense. I may or may not want to live in Oregon, but I think they ought to be able to try that, just as I think you know, people with very different approaches elsewhere should be able to try them.
John Kitzhaber for 20 years now has been one of the real visionaries in terms of health policy in the United States. It comes up with some really challenging ideas. I'm just a political hack, okay? I'm just like your plumber in your basement, and I'm going to tell you if you put these two pipes together, are you going to see flow, or are you going to have a goddamn mess on your hands, okay? And the bottom line is this, 80% of Americans in poll after poll want everybody covered, except when you say the way we're going to cover them is to require you to pay more, then you say, well, I want everybody covered, but that's not what I meant, because I'm already paying enough. And as much as Stewart puts it forward, and I agree, that the tax treatment of health insurance is a disgrace and is an extraordinary resource to use if we could get that money and flip it to pay for subsidies to people based on income. The difficulty with that is to make that transition, and that's really the heart of what Kitzhaber is putting out there, is let's take the money from the tax deductibility of insurance, federal and state, and make that the financing vehicle to revolutionize the system, means that a gigantic number of people out there who already feel like they're paying too much are going to be told they're going to be paying a lot more, and they're going to come at him with a pitchfork. Mm-hmm. And that's the bottom line. So, frankly, being just very opportunistic in terms of Massachusetts, we're asking ourselves, we want to expand coverage, we need to put more money on the table to pay for it. How can we do it in a way that doesn't generate revolution? And what we have come up with in Massachusetts, and what you're seeing indications of in Walmart is that you can, in fact, get broad public support around the idea that the employers who are paying nothing or contributing very minimally in terms of meeting any obligation to their workers, in fact, should put more money on the table. And that is, in fact, a financing source to move the system forward, to move coverage forward, which, in fact, has a real potential of passing the critically important test of political viability.
Well, let's stay west of the Mississippi still, we have a caller in line from Texas. Caller, please go ahead.
My name is Arturo Robles, a private consultant in healthcare, the master's degree. I like very much what you are saying regarding first illusion of the cost of healthcare, that it really, in terms that it does affect everybody. We live in an illusion that, a dollar spent on healthcare doesn't affect the taxpayers as well as the people that are providing, employers are providing healthcare insurance. However, my question is regarding, there's absolutely no way that I can see a solution to this insured problem unless we take a look at getting the government out of providing insurance. I mean, there's the question of subsidy is, to me, it's a more probable answer to actually having the government provide insurance and have the providers, the healthcare plans, compete at that level. And with this in regard, also, there is also an illusion out there that the poor and the older, it costs more in the insurance pool. And there's been several studies that I have read that actually that's not true. At the beginning, it might cost more. I think Hawaii found that because their health care, especially the uninsured health care, people are not practicing health care, or they don't have the practice of a continuum of health care.
Right. Thanks for your question. Let's get to our panelists and get their point of view. And Stuart, this sounds certainly along the lines of views that you've expressed in the past.
Yes. I mean, I understood the caller on this. I mean, I think that there are different models about how one should move forward, and they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. I think one model is saying it's better to look at how to help people afford what's available, which gets you down a kind of a subsidy road. And as far as possible, you don't want the subsidy you give them to be somehow conditioned upon the particular place they work, which is what we do with the tax subsidy today. or that they've got to enroll in a state program like Medicaid to get the subsidy. You want to try to direct it more to people's needs and so on. And that gets you down the road of everything from these refundable tax credit proposals to other kinds of subsidy, which is, I think, what the caller's sort of arguing, that why don't we go down that road so then people can afford things. I think that certainly gets you a lot of the way, and that's broadly what I would favor. I certainly do agree that, on the other hand, that we do have to have an insurance organization component to this, because notwithstanding any change or without any change in the insurance rules, you are going to find some people, even if they're given a subsidy, given their medical condition, still unable to actually afford to buy whatever's available. So I think there's an element of that. So whilst I'm a minimalist,
the individual insurance market where
right, well, that's right, it's all restricted that way. So I'm not in favor of zero government involvement in this. I certainly take the point from the caller that there are a lot of unintended consequences of large-scale government organization of the healthcare system. And I come from a country, Britain, that did that in a very extensive way, and I think there are downsides to that. But I do think that some, certain rules and cross-subsidies within the insurance system are a piece of the equation, but the direct subsidy to people is the primary thing. And that's why I contrast that with these other approaches that say, well, let's force employers to pay the subsidy or somebody else. I think that's a very messy way of doing it. Politically, it may be easier, but I don't think that gets you down the road you really want to go, which I think is consistent with what the caller said.
We had another email from Ohio, which I want to read it to you. We keep hearing that medical savings accounts are needed so that patients face higher out-of-pocket costs to make them more sensitive to the cost of medical care. Americans already face the highest out-of-pocket costs in the industrial world and has done little to control costs. From an average person's point of view, the idea that they're overinsured or that they're not paying enough doesn't necessarily ring true to them as the solution to the problem. How would you respond to that?
Well, I mean, Americans always feel that they should get more than everybody else and not pay as much and so on. And I see this in all of this equation. I think over the long run, though, we are never going to see a ratcheting down of total health costs, certainly as a percentage of our gross national product, and a more equitable arrangement, unless we have some kind of situation where people have more perception of the relative costs and benefits of different procedures or different plans, and they're sort of in that position. At the same time, that we make sure that people who really, because they lack adequate income, have enough to be able to afford at least an adequate level. We've got to move in that direction. As long as people are making decisions as individuals where they have no concept of the relative cost, you either have one of two things. Either you have what we have in this country, which is exploding costs because the bills are paid, or you have a sort of a British type of system where there's essentially a budget.
Okay,
you can have it, but it's just not available.
Stuart, what major advanced industrial country on the planet requires more cost-sharing by individuals than the United States?
Yeah, but that's not the question.
That's a bad question.
We pay more out-of-pocket and get far more in the United States. That's the, we spend a much larger amount of our economy on health care for people.
We don't get better, more
we
outcomes.
We get more things. No, I agree with you. I'm not arguing about that. Uh-huh. I'm just saying we're paying more.
No, but I mean, if cost-sharing were the answer, then wouldn't we not be the leading example of exploding costs in the world, because we're already doing more of it than any other country?
Let me answer your question. If we try to reduce the cost sharing, the amount that people pay directly, and we don't do anything about the total amount that's spent, somebody else has to pay that amount. So that's a dynamic that we have in this country. We have many people, they maybe have a large out-of-pocket expenses, but they also have somebody else paying a huge amount of their health care.
Typically an employer.
And they will make decisions accordingly. They will want this, they will want that, they will call their Congress
but other
and say,
countries,
give me, I know.
Other countries that have a lot less cost sharing
are not seeing
our explosion in costs.
Sure, and what are they doing? They're ratcheting down the total amount that's spent. That has consequences. If you live in Britain, as I have done,
Britain is by itself, it's an island.
Thank you.
What's another system like Britain?
Almost any other country.
Talk about France, talk about Germany, talk about Japan, talk about Australia. Right. Very different models. None of them use cost sharing to the extent that we do. So they should be having higher inflation if your theory held.
No, Stuart, I think what you're saying is that, there are other mechanisms
in some way
that they're using.
The availability of care. That's what they do.
Right.
And, well, thank you. So we have some options here. We can reduce out-of-pocket expenses by either shifting to somebody else and saying, get somebody else to pay for it and don't limit the amount of care, make them give me more care. That has one consequence. Or we can say we'll limit it by essentially putting some brakes on how much is spent on health care.
If you do that, your partner, Henry,
you have to start looking at forms of rationing, which my friend Henry Aaron is strongly in favor of.
Do you think we don't ration here in the United States?
Yeah, we just do it in a very bad way.
We sure do.
But Americans.
But so to say that the wolf at the door is rationing,
I can finish my
it's
point.
Here.
Americans basically are in. Take the view that they don't want rationing, they don't want limits, they just want to not pay much, and they want somehow the health care to appear. That's the problem, which anybody who looks at surveys on health care, as I'm sure you've done, you know, very quickly comes up with, or talks to anybody in the street. They want more, they don't want to pay as much, they want somehow it to happen. And that's the thing that, as long as Americans take that view, we are not going to be able to make the fundamental decisions that are needed in this area.
Well, the two fundamental myths here are, number one, that it's individual consumers' fault for the explosion in healthcare costs, which we fundamentally reject. And the second is that the solution to our problems is more market competition. We are the difference between us and every other nation on the planet is the extent to which we say the market is a solution. Will Rogers had a saying, he said, when you're in a hole, stop digging. That's the first thing to do. And we are in this hole of market competition, and people keep saying, well, we've got to dig faster, we've got to have a new shovel, we've got to dig over here rather than there. We've got to understand that the market itself is not going to lead us out of this.
Well, I'm quite certain we're not going to solve this one in an hour. Let me bring you in. And Stuart,
me into this. Thank you.
We'll change the subject.
Here, come on.
Stuart mentioned the idea of transparency in the system, and we got an email question about asking whether any states are doing anything to make prices of healthcare more transparent. I mean, right now in most places, you can talk about free market competition. It's hard to call up a doctor, call up a hospital, and ask, what's your price? And are there any state initiatives to try and to make the system a little more transparent to consumers?
That's a terrific question, and a problem that comes up, and I hear amongst state leaders all the time, particularly when they're considering health savings accounts or consumer-directed care and how that will impact their market. I don't know of any initiatives that I can point to right now, but it is a critical issue, and sort of expecting an individual to be able to make these decisions and to navigate the system, there clearly needs to be a lot more information out there and certainly recognition of that.
It's Stuart. Let me... Medicare Part D and the system for providing that, the drug benefit under Medicare, introduced some additional transparency in at least out-of-pocket costs for consumers, the ability to compare. Is that a direction you see policy going?
I think that feature of the Medicare drug benefit is certainly a step forward to kind of make it possible for you to compare and to choose. I think that is a value we have in America, whether you like it or not. People want to make these choices. I think that's right. But I think, just so that we don't let this pass, I think that the Medicare Part D program, the drug benefit, does also build in the same kind of illusions that somehow we can take what you've been paying up to now, we'll pass it over to this Medicare program, never mind what the future costs look like. You know, we're basically doing what Ford and GM did 20 years ago to make these commitments without any knowledge of how we can possibly pay for them. So I think when I look at the Medicare drug legislation, I see, you know, many different features, parts of it. Some I think are steps in the right direction, but the basic element of just simply saying, let's take on this responsibility, including for people who can perfectly afford to pay for it themselves, commit future taxpayers and unborn taxpayers to pay for this. I think it's just building up a further crisis in the Medicare program 10 or 15 years from now.
Right. I definitely don't want to go down that path
with
15 minutes left in the show. But let's go back to the callers, and we have a caller, another one from the West Coast, from Washington State. Please go ahead.
Yeah, this is Nathan from Washington, and a question for the panelists. Can they address the potential impact of the federal deficit reduction bill on states if it is indeed repassed by the House in several days, specifically as it relates to long-term care, as well as the expansion of flexibility to states for cost sharing.
And just a little background, Alice, I don't know if you could describe some of the elements of the budget reconciliation legislation, which, as I understand it now, has passed the Senate and will go back to the House in the next week or two.
Yes, that's right. And in that bill, there are about $4.8 billion of savings that are assumed in the Medicaid program, which clearly will have an impact on states. The caller is asking about long-term care, and I have to qualify that that's not the area that I do a lot of work in, but there certainly are savings that are anticipated in the changes in Medicaid through changes in the asset and the look-back period. So states will be
sort of restricting the ability of people to transfer assets
to get
on Medicaid.
So states will now look back for a longer period of time at an individual's income before they're eligible for Medicaid, so some changes there. There are also changes, some large changes in the program in terms of the co-payments and benefit flexibility that states will have on the broader coverage issues in their program. And for states there, that is from a state's perspective, that is an option for them to exercise. I think it raises a question, which now we're having a debate about how much flexibility really are we willing to have across states and what states might do with that flexibility. But clearly, there is new flexibility in this Deficit Reduction Act that will result likely in changes in many different states.
And John, what's your view of that particular issue? I mean, is that a direction we should be going in, that people under Medicaid, low-income people, paying higher co-payments for services that they're getting?
Well, no. People are paying higher co-pays and deductibles, very poor people with very limited or no income, basically to pay for tax cuts for the wealthy, to balance it out. And it's just, it's immoral. And it's also counterproductive, we think, in terms of the decisions that people will make to not obtain necessary medications and treatments that will lead to higher cost treatments down the road. So we think it's a very bad direction to go in. We don't think it makes sense, and again, it is saying that it is individual consumers who are the fault of our out-of-control system, and that somehow a poor person in St. Louis should know better in terms of what to do than all these smart people here in Washington. It's just passing on responsibility, we think, in a very unfair and counterproductive way.
Stuart, let me ask you, going back to your vision of greater flexibility in financing for states. There is connected to this issue of how much poor people should pay. We can argue about how much that should be, and I'm sure everyone here won't agree. But is that an element that is appropriately part of federal guidelines?
You know, that of course has been an issue for many years here and across countries. When I was brought up in Britain, there was a raging debate for 20 years when I lived there, about whether people should pay something towards prescriptions in Britain. Not the full cost, but something. And, of course, the argument was not poor people somehow immoral, but that we've got to have some disincentive for people to keep on requesting more and more medication. That was the argument. And people of good faith on both sides of that argument. But that was the issue. I think that's the issue here, or should be the issue here. Certainly, I'm in favor of efficiency in government. I think that if our aim is to help people get coverage, we should target that help as much as possible. But I do also recognize that the actual decisions people make when they're confronted with choices is critically important about what the total costs are. This is not a moral issue. It's a question of saying, how do people act? Do they make choices? And to that extent, I think, this is why I think any of these approaches to Medicaid like this that alter out of pocket have got to be done in combination with what is our objective. Our objective is to ensure that people get appropriate and adequate health care of these income levels. If some combination of altering what people pay but also maybe providing more services in some way ends up with a better health care outcome, we should at least consider that and not just have as like an icon that nobody should have to pay anything if they're below a certain income level. If the end result is better care for more people, then I think we should at least contemplate those options. And I think that's what we've got to do in this. That's what we ought to be doing.
And do you think we know enough about how people respond?
No, I don't. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's important to have variety. So if you say to the state, okay, we've made it possible for you now to alter the payment amounts and out of pocket. That's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is that you've got to use this flexibility in ways that make a plausible, have a plausible way of improving coverage, extending it at a reasonable amount to people, and we will measure your outcomes. And then if you don't show that you're achieving that, then we're, you know, what you want to do has to cease. I think that's, in my view, the best way to find the right answer. I don't know what the right answer is. I don't think any of us really know what the right answer is. We may have ideas, there are studies. We don't know if they're universal. We don't know if they're necessarily perfectly, you know, perfect studies. So I think we have to move in that direction. I want to move in this direction cautiously. I'm very sensitive to what John said about the fairness issue, which I strongly agree with. But we don't know some of these effects. And the out-of-pocket, as I said, it's not a penalty. It shouldn't be seen as a penalty on low-income people. It should be seen as one piece of an equation that might affect the decision-making made by somebody just because they happen to have low income. We still want them to make, you know, rational, good decisions about value for money and encourage them to do that in some way with help.
And Alice, what's your sense of how states would react to flexibility like this?
One, I think states often always, be careful about using the word always, but are looking for flexibility. I'm sitting here listening to this discussion and remembering when I was in a Medicaid program and sitting in a budget office and trying to make decisions about what we would do. And I very much wanted the flexibility then to be able to increase a premium or to do something rather than having to cut people off of coverage. So where I sat, I thought, well, we're making good decisions. Of course I want the flexibility to make the decisions. It's, again, a national policy debate about how much, you know, are some other states' decisions going to be good? Would my decisions be good in another place? I do think we are beginning to know a lot or beginning to see a lot more about cost sharing in Oregon, actually. They had to apply a premium to an adult population that had coverage and really enforce that premium in a new way. And there's been some study and look at that. And I think we need to be realistic about what happens. About half of the people lost coverage. This is a population that's under 100% of poverty. So it's, about $10,000 for an adult. So when they're being charged a premium, I don't think it's all that surprising that half would not be paying that premium. But it's different when you're thinking about maybe an S-CHIP program or a coverage level in Massachusetts. If you're going up to 200% of poverty, you might think about a premium or cost sharing there. So, again, this is, I think, a starting you have to consider where a state is and who they cover, what the base population is, and sort of what are the levels of flexibility that might be applied.
I think right now just about all states do, in fact, require cost sharing of folks at a variety of income levels. I think what's going on in Washington right now is increasing that as a way to claim budget savings to pay for outrageous tax cuts to wealthy, hugely wealthy Americans. That's what's going on here. And that's immoral. That is immoral.
Well, we should, at some other program, get into the discussion of what's appropriate tax policy. Putting that aside,
I'm not sure we've solved anything in this hour, but hopefully we've illuminated. And final questions here. And Alice, looking into your crystal policy ball, which I know you have, what kind of activity, what should we be seeing, looking for over the next year from states? Are we going to see a ramping up of activity, a ramping up of talk, and not much activity? I mean, what are your predictions?
Hard to say. That crystal ball of mine is hazy, as I like to say. I think that we'll see a lot of states looking and evaluating the flexibility that they do have if the budget reconciliation package moves forward. I think there's even the flexibility of allowing consumer direction in the Medicaid program, and I think states will look at that and consider it. Hopefully we will see coverage initiatives move forward and things, significant expansions in some states. We're sensitive to time, so I'll let you pass on.
I think what we've got is we've got, and I hate to say it, kind of a red state, blue state phenomenon. And what I see is I see blue states largely looking to expand coverage through public means and through private means. And what I see red states doing is seeking flexibility to limit spending and to cut down on either eligibility or benefits that people get. So in the red states, you see Tennessee cutting 220,000 people off Tennacare in the fall, Missouri cutting 80,000 people off last spring. Florida and South Carolina looking for vouchers to give people on Medicaid a fixed dollar. So it's not perfect, but it seems to me, it just strikes me how much this is turning into a red state, blue state phenomena in terms of which direction states are having. And I think that's going to grow and not decrease.
Well, John, let me ask you, I mean, one other feature of this year is it's an election year, a midterm election year, and certainly many state officials up for election as well. You served 12 years as an elected official. You may feel yourself fortunate that you're no longer an elected official. What would you tell a candidate, whether it's a Democratic candidate or a Republican candidate, about what they should be talking about with regards to health care this year, the messages that or policies that would resonate with the public?
We have a health system that at its core is immoral. I hate to keep using that word, but it is, because it rations medically necessary care based upon income and ability to pay. And while things look dismal now, things change very rapidly in the context of the United States. In 1997, Congress created the S-CHIP program, which was the biggest expansion in Medicaid since it was created in 1965. And I was very involved in that as a state legislator at the time. And literally 5 or 6 months before it happened, there wasn't a politically smart person here in Washington who said that's got a snowball's chance in hell of happening, and 5 months later it did. So things can shift very quickly, so take heart and have confidence. Things are going to get better.
Well, and Stuart, you live in a blue state kind of area here in Washington, but you're a red state kind of guy, I think. next week, the president is giving a State of the Union address, and all reports are that health care will be a prominent portion of that address. Give a sense, based on the reports, of how you think that might change the landscape of this debate. Will it shift it in a certain direction?
Well, I hope what it does is elevate the discussion of it. I mean, I think one of the criticisms in recent years has been we haven't seen enough prominence for healthcare. I think, as somebody who vehemently wants to see change in healthcare, I think that's a big step forward. I think it should be taken as that. I think it's more important that we raise the prominence, have discussion. I say that because I think that amid all this debate and frustration, there is actually underneath a very honest discussion and a consensus building on the need to deal with this issue. People across the spectrum, I think, are meeting, as I am and others, in good faith efforts to try to move the ball forward. We're seeing proposals on Capitol Hill, not from the leadership, but from people like Senator Bingaman, Congresswoman Baldwin, Congressman Price, and so on, who all want to kind of move forward together in a bipartisan way. And I think it's very important that we encourage those efforts, which tend to be based on encouraging us to agree on a commitment to this, to have some diversity, and so on. I think we've got to make sure that happens. We don't just end up with a kind of political fist fight as soon as the State of the Union takes place.
What kind of time frame do you think we're looking at? I mean, is it can we expect action this year or the next 5 years, the next 10 years?
Well, certainly not. I don't think anything serious this year. You know, the old joke says that God looked at the situation and said there will be health care reform, but not in my lifetime. I wouldn't be that pessimistic. But I think what we need to try to do this year is to begin to kind of work on this, what's happening at the state level, focusing more on what the lessons are, building bipartisan approaches that allow different approaches to go forward, because people on either side of the spectrum will not allow the other person's approach to dominate the whole country. And therefore, we've got to allow diversity of approaches, providing we have some agreement on what the overall objectives are. And I don't think we're that far apart on that. I mean, I think the system's ethically challenged, too. And I think we need to do something about this. It's more of a sort of an engineering dispute about what is the best way to do it. And that, I think, is solved by allowing different approaches and comparing them.
I think one thing we haven't, as I said, I don't think we've solved anything today, but I think we have learned that there are places, whether it's Massachusetts or Illinois or Maryland or somewhere else, where there is some of that bipartisan coming together and some possibility of some tangible progress. So let's hope the debate does get elevated, whether it's in Washington and or in the states. I want to thank all of you for joining us and for your thoughtful comments. I'm Larry Levitt. You've been watching KaiserNetwork.org. Thanks again to our panel of experts, and thanks to you for joining us. We'll see you next time on Ask the Experts.